Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the B-Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Kautzer. And yes, I did leave you for a little while, as the immortal Jay-Z would say, but I'm back. And yes, it has been 2 weeks in the making, but I made a promise to you guys on my last podcast that I would have the AFI 2017 diary for you. And for your listening pleasure, I now present that to you. It's going to be one long-ass episode. Buckle up. You're going to notice that there will be little intersoles in between. It'll be a film flickering sound, like an old school 35 millimeter projector. And that will denote each time a new entry comes in. And if you want to know the movies that we're going to be talking about, and there will be non-spoilery, just quick thoughts from me during the festival, you're going to hear various, like, you'll probably hear various grades of sound. It was because I recorded it between my old school Sony digital voice recorder and my iPhone's voice memo. So this is as punk rock as it gets. This is going back old school. This is like the first generation of B-Movie Podcast entries that I was bringing to you guys originally, when it was just this micro podcast that has evolved and changed into something a little bit different. It's taking it back old school, kind of like, you know, the audio quality isn't that great because I'm typically on the road while I'm talking to you guys, or parked in my car while the air conditioning is running because it was unseasonably warm during AFI 2017. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually come back to you. There is one film that is missing from my entries because it bowled me over that much. And we'll talk about that film at the ending of this podcast. So you'll hear the flicker and then I'll come back and we'll talk about that film and then the stuff that's coming up in December, because I've got some pretty kick-ass shit coming at you. So we'll talk about that. So without further ado, we've got our B-Movie Podcast going, a little A-Movie Podcast on you guys, but, you know, we're keeping it real by having the shit on the fly, so you're gonna hear weird, like, stammerings and me probably going off a little bit grumpier than I normally am, because, I mean, you know, we're talking about me at a film fest when I'm both working full-time and also, you know, coming down with a cold, which in one of the episodes, I think it was towards the end, I do mention that I have a film fest flu, and it, like, by the end of the film festival, it was a full on flu, and I had to, you know, I just had to recover from it. It was also part of the reason why this has been delayed. So without further bullshit and, you know, recompense, here comes the 2017 AFI film diary. We're back. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Friday. I've just finished my first day at the AFI Film Festival, and we're talking about the first movie that I saw, the opening of my festival, The Shape of Water, written and directed, I should actually clarify that, co-written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, starring Sally Hawkins, Doug Jones, Michael Shannon, Octavia Spencer, Richard Jenkins, and a personal favorite of mine, Michael Stahlberg.
And let's just kind of get into it. We're going to talk a little bit about the experience itself. I'll talk a little bit about the film, kind of give you maybe some insights that maybe might not be in my review. I don't know, because I haven't written my review yet. Or I started it, and it's turning out to be one of those really big, long-winded ones. So if it ends up being like a 1,300-word review of this, do not be surprised. And if it is, my sincerest apologies to my editor, Scott Phillips. Sorry, bro. But, I mean, this movie's beautiful, and we'll get into this directly. But, taking a step back, just to talk about the actual festival itself and the opening night, at least for me. This was actually screened at my favorite theater, the Hollywood Egyptian. And I will tell you, the experience of, like, trying to get in line and getting into the theater was not the most pleasant experience. I'm going to chalk it up to the fact that it's literally the first night. It's not the premiere gala opening night was on Thursday, but this is the first official festival day on Friday. I'm going to chalk it up to opening night jitters for these people, because it was a little stressful. It's a little stressful when a security guard is fucking telling you that you need to put your laptop away when you're fucking press, and you're reviewing films and you need to, like, you know, have your laptop on you so that you can write reviews in between or begin reviews in between, your screenings, and having to literally argue with the festival staff that I'm not going to pull out my fucking laptop during the film. I'm not a fucking pirate, but they were treating me as though I was going to do something really shady and illegal. There's nothing like, you know, give somebody that has press credentials the benefit of the doubt. I mean, it all got sorted out, but it was not the way that I wanted to start the festival, where I'm literally, like, having a very heated discussion with people over the fact that I kind of need my laptop so I can begin reviews, and it's not going to come out of my bag. It was not the way that I wanted to start my festival. But that did not color the screening itself. The film is beautiful and gorgeous and unique and odd and everything that you expect from a Guillermo del Toro film. This movie feels like he's officially turned a page in his directing career with The Shape of Water. The Shape of Water finds Del Toro working in a similar manner that he would in his Spanish films, but it's in English. So it used to be there was a clear delineation between Del Toro's more artistic endeavors and his more populist endeavors, or his tentpole movies. His tentpole movies had were always in English, of course, and his art house or his artistic fair was in Spanish. And this film kind of bridges that gap and gives us what I would like to say is Guillermo del Toro version 3.0, which means that it's very interesting, because there's this whimsical, hopeful quality to the film. A daringness, shall I say, to the film's story, the way that he shot it, the editing, the performances. It's a film that, after, I cried twice in it. There are two moments. One that I'm not gonna tell you where they come, but there are two moments that just, like, I welled up with tears. I got very emotional. And one was not so much about the emotion of the story, but the bravado and the braveness that Del Toro, Doug Jones, and Sally Hawkins approached a certain particular scene, and the way that they were able to pull it off. It almost feels like this scene, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. I won't ruin what it is. I won't even ruin what it's a very specific scene, and the way that the way that it's filmed, the way that it's approached, it just feels like a moment that has been inside of Del Toro's head for probably the last 50 years. Since he was a kid, he had it, this idea in his mind. And this scene is a purely original, purely Guillermo del Toro moment. Something that I don't think that we've ever seen from him or from anybody for that matter. And it's played with such honesty and heart and in a moment of just pure bliss. It shook me. It choked me up. Even now it's hard to describe it, and maybe it's because it's 2 o'clock in the fucking morning and I'm really tired, but I'm high on like really good film, amazing film, and that's what Del Toro delivers. It's different than his previous entries. It feels like he has been reborn anew, giving us something different. I had made mention of the color palette in my the color palette, and he's done. It feels like he's finally officially done with the Amber Nights and the Steel Blue days. He's kind of gone into this, shall we call it a green phase. This film is like, you know, hued in all shapes and sizes and hues of green. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. It, in a way, it recalls like the best work of Jean-Pierre Jeunet, not just in the whimsy, but in the construction and the visuals. I mean, I think that Del Toro and Jeunet, along with like Hayao Miyazaki, have always been kind of interrelated to me. Like they feel like they're of the same kind of hive mind, and it works. I think that it's the trailer is very misleading. I don't know how you can create a trailer for this film, so I applaud Fox Searchlight for trying to attempt to come up with something, but I think that it's a film that would be almost impossible to cut a trailer to that can give you an idea of the way that Del Toro is very easily and ably to juggle tone and tonal shifts. It's a very daring movie, but it, more so than that, it's an accomplished movie. Like, the dare that Del Toro has set out for himself, he succeeds at, and he succeeds with style. This is a movie that mixes romance and sexuality, something that we never see in films. I think that oftentimes we either see romance or we see sexuality. We don't ever see them commingling together in somehow, some way, in this weird alchemy. Del Toro was able to produce something that feels representative of both romance and sexuality. And Sally Hawkins, just, she's an amazing, the performance that she gives is amazing. It's probably, like, at this point, it is my favorite performance of the year. Like, just so brave, so thoughtful and considered, and fully realized. Like one of the things I feel like doesn't really get portrayed properly in film is anybody's sexual nature. Like, and somehow Del Toro is able to make Eliza, Elsa, who is the Sally Hawkins character, a sexual being without it being, without it feeling like it's a bad thing, like it's the only soul characteristic that she has. Like, oftentimes in films, like, when somebody is sexual in nature, they have this tendency to make them that soul quality, and it's not. And it's just completely integrated into the film. I'm still really, really kind of shaken by that, and how Del Toro, I think, understands sexuality in a way that is, it's not just interesting, but he's right, and he knows how to show that visually. There's a lot of, this is what I would consider a female-centric visual style, like the way that the sexuality is approached and the way that the visuals work. Everything like, it makes sense to me now, the reason why the film is called The Shape of Water. And, well, not only because it's based off a poem, but the film uses water and wetness as a strong, like, visual thematic, and never realizing, like, that's a very female sexual oriented visual, and he uses it so beautifully, and not in a perverse or demented sort of way. It's interesting, because I'm really curious about how people are going to receive this film, because of the fact that it deals with sexuality, but it deals with it in such a healthy way. It doesn't look at sex as a damning or, like, guilt-ridden, like, act of attrition that some of his films seem to postulate in regards to sex. I think that there's a very... He has a very strong Catholic upbringing, and that kind of becomes a very strong point in his previous work in dealing with sexuality. He even mentioned it during the commentary in Devil's Backbone, that, like, you know, he approached, like, at least in that movie, he approached it, and it seems like every single time that he does have sexuality in his films, he approaches it not from a negative standpoint, but it's a very... It comes from a very unhealthy point of view, I guess I should say. Like, it's the closest thing I can come to the way that I feel like he approaches it. It's not unhealthy, but it seems like there's always ulterior motives. But this is the first film where I feel like the sexuality in it that he has in it, it's a liberating experience. It's an experience that strengthens somebody and gives them courage and bonds them to someone, and but also making some counterpoints in regards to sex and sexuality with the Michael Shannon character. But I think that it's probably his most mature work, and it's the first film I feel like he's dealing with adults from an adult perspective, and it's not the fact that he has been able to approach this from this perspective, and it's not his normal, you know, from children or like within his big studio budget films, like, say, Crimson Peak. It becomes very complicated. I think that what's interesting to me is that the entire time I was watching it, I kept on thinking about how I feel like Crimson Peak really informed The Shape of Water. Like, it really felt like Crimson Peak, or not Crimson Peak itself, but Crimson Peak informed the creation and the writing of this particular film. Like, the criticisms that were laid at him in regards to Crimson Peak in certain regards were addressed. Like, he took them to heart, and it was almost like this is a reaction to that film's reception. And it's interesting how this film is, like, ultimately what it's about, and the thematics. I'm going to leave a little bit more up to you guys to be able to see this film. It's opening December 8th in New York and LA, and then widening out throughout the award season. You probably are not going to be able to see it until January. I'm thinking it's probably going to get the big, huge Oscar push. It will... I hope to God it gets at least nominated, because I think that people will approach it with a lot more consideration. This film definitely requires an open mind when you see it. It's all to say, like, you know, you start off with something that's like you have a strong feeling is going to be a classic, and it's like, whoa, fuck, what am I supposed to do from here? So, what does end up happening is you get a nasty bit of business called VIP, and we'll look at that next. Next up is VIP, the South Korean serial killer versus cops thriller directed by Hong Joon Park. Now, I know that a lot of people will just go, oh, another serial killer versus cops entry. But if you say that and you don't know the name Hong Joon Park, then you've never seen I Saw the Devil. And if you've never seen I Saw the Devil, I don't know if you should really be listening to this right now. I think that maybe you should fucking stop this podcast and find I Saw the Devil and watch it. I'm gonna give you the... Eventually, this is going to be covered, and I think that we're going to be covering it with the progenitor of Film Dispenser, Spencer Howard, because he's got an affinity for South Korean films, as most of us genre freaks do. And I will give you this for I Saw the Devil. If you've never seen this movie before, this is the pitch. It's James Bond versus Hannibal Lecter. If you don't want to see that fucking film, I don't know what I can do about this for you. But getting back to VIP, this is Park's fourth film that he's directed. It's about the eighth script that he's written. And I will tell you, VIP is about as accomplished as I Saw the Devil in the way that it's directed and scripted. It is a tight, taut, really well made, executed, and especially acted thriller that is told on a bigger scale than you might expect. This one is actually released internationally by Warner Brothers with a deal with South Korean film. Like, they have a pretty big South Korean film arm that they're, you know, basically producing these films. It was released in this year in South Korea, and hopefully it's going to be released in home video sometime in 2018, I guess, or 2017. I mean, I'd love to see it get released on some screens so that people could actually see it, because it's definitely a big image, like big screen action film. I mean, it's saying an action film is calling it is really stretching it, but it's got the rhythms and the pacing of an action film, and I will tell you, this fucking movie delivers. It has probably one of the best villains in the last 10 years of film. I swear to God, guys, like, this is no shit. Like, I know this is probably, I'm recording this, what, around 3 o'clock in the morning? I don't give a fuck. I'm telling you guys, this shit, this movie is legit. You need to fucking see this movie. It played Fantastic Fest, where it got a lot of rave reviews, and it definitely earns those rave reviews. I cannot express to you how badass this movie is. I think it's probably the baddest ass movie I'm going to see at the festival this year. I honestly think so. It's definitely well worth it. Again, it's a serial killer movie. I don't want to give you too many details because I think that it would partially ruin the film, because I went in with just the log line of this film about three different police officials that are chasing down one serial killer on an international stage. And that's it. That's all I will leave you with, except for one additional thing. Peter Stormare is in this fucking movie. Now, Of course, he plays, like, the best part is that he plays a U.S. government official. And I will leave it at that, but it's full-on Peter Stormare. I mean, we're not talking, like, you know, like Peter Stormare, you know, like not like Coen Brothers, where he's used efficiently and for a purpose. We're talking deranged, no filter. We're gonna let him do whatever we want. He wants, like, that kind of freakish, like, weird Peter Stormare. So with that, guys, you definitely need to check out this fucking movie. It will be coming out soon, and I'm pretty sure that the B-Movie Podcast is going to be making sure that you are well aware of when it's released. So I just got out of Claire's Camera and a couple of other films that I'll be discussing in a later segment, but we're talking about Claire's Camera. It's okay. I think the problem for me is that it was a little too esoteric for my tastes. He's usually this director. It's Hong Soo Bong. And my apologies if it's not, but it, like, this director is very specifically, his films deal very specifically with relationships and do it in a very different way, like, every time. Like, his films are exclusively about relationships, and very much so kind of Woody Allen-esque, if you will. Which he makes so, and like Woody Allen, he makes so many films. Like, I think that they were saying something like, he has made over 100 films, kind of like Takashi Miike, which some are good, some are bad. I mean, I think I've seen at least 6 or 7 of his films, and this one interested me for one reason and one reason only, and that is because it stars the indomitable Isabelle Huppert, and, Isabelle Huppert is, like, one of those actresses for me, or just actors in general for me, that I will see fucking anything that she puts out. Her performances are always on point. Like, she is one of the actresses that I've, like, you know, or one of the actors that I've just gravitated towards for a good chunk of my life. She's the reason why I know about Michael Haneke. And I knew about Michael Haneke when I did, because, I mean, she worked with the man. She's like, you know, I remember her very vividly from Heaven's Gate. I mean, she just blew me away in that film. I mean, like, I talked about this on a previous podcast where, you know, I talked about Heaven's Gate in a 2-part episode, where she was just, like, she was entrancing to me. She was beautiful, she was otherworldly, but she had this power, this gravitas to her that you watched her and you could feel everything that she felt in that movie. And I just, like, over the years, going through her filmography, which I still haven't gotten through everything on, of course, like, when you look at her IMDb page, you'll understand why. I find that her work is, like, regardless of the movie that she's in, and there are some movies that are pretty, pretty fucking shitty, she is always fucking on point and always amazing. And in Claire's Camera, she is. I think that she's the sole thing that works in this film. It's just a little too, like I said, it's a little too esoteric for my taste. And there's nothing wrong with that, but if you're going to go see it for anything, see it for Isabelle Huppert and her just owning this fucking movie. So my plans have been completely fucked up. I made the mistake of trying to get to this. AFI had announced on today, Saturday morning, that they were having a Thor Ragnarok screening, followed by a Dolby Vision Q&A about Dolby Vision, and since the first time I saw Dolby Vision on Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I've been very interested in this particular process, and I mean, the chance to see Thor Ragnarok kind of reset myself, and also get a great Q&A in. But the problem was that when I got out of my last film, there was literally, I don't know, an hour to get there. So an hour on Saturday afternoon in Hollywood was not the best thing to do, because it wasn't showing at the Chinese or the Egyptian, which are just kind of stone throws away from one another, but it's at the Vine Theater, what used to be called the Vine, but now it's called the Dolby Vision Theater at Vine, which I don't fucking get, whatever. But anybody who lives in LA who's gone to the Vine Theater knows one thing about the Vine Theater: the parking fucking sucks. And so I tried to make it there with my car because of the time constraints, and literally spent time in traffic, and then, of course, like, no possibility of actually getting a parking spot. So I basically fucked myself. I'm not gonna blame the AFI because they were just, you know, they were just adding the screening in as a part of their panel's discussion more than anything else. And I felt like I needed to get in another panel because I'm going to be seeing the Chris Nolan Dunkirk panel and screening, hopefully. The way that things are fucking going, I don't know. But it's all to say that I definitely tried, but it kind of fucked me. So I'm driving back to the Chinese to go and figure out if I can watch something, but probably pretty much have fucked myself out of watching anything else. But we'll see. We'll definitely see. But yeah, I've been fairly, like, the interesting thing is that, like, you know, through my festival going experiences, I've been pretty lucky to get into basically everything that I've ever wanted to get into, barring, like, you know, special screenings and such, at the festivals that I've gone to. This is, like, the first time that things have just kind of been a little messier than I've ever expected them to be. So, you know, you roll with the fucking punches. But we'll see what happens, we'll kind of go from there. I'm just gonna plop something. I'm probably gonna plop something out of thin air, figure out what the fuck I need to do, because I need to fill up that time gap before I go see Gemini. So, the next film that I did actually see was Mr. Roosevelt, written, directed, and starring Noelle Wells. And this one was okay. It didn't work for me. You know, that's the thing with film festivals. I'm not gonna knock it too hard. It wasn't for me. It's just, I don't deal well with, you know, the specific kind of indie comedy it was. It just wasn't for me. It was a taste thing. So it's well constructed, but it just didn't work for me from head to toe. I mean, great, like, you know, I could see the performances, and it's pretty accomplished. I love the fact that she shot on 16mm, like, actual film. She uses some great locations, both in Austin and Los Angeles, but it was all for naught. It's one of those, you know, narcissistic indie comedies where, you know, they show all of these horrible people, and at the end of it, there's supposed to be some minor tweak or change where the characters learn something, and I just didn't feel it. So you can look for it. It should be coming out in the next couple of weeks in limited release and VOD. Give it a chance if, like, indie comedy is your thing, and a very specific indie comedy. I mean, the trailer does definitely sell exactly what you're getting from this movie. So if you like that, by all means. But those expecting something along the lines of, say, The Big Sick, stay with the Big Sick. Look elsewhere, because this is not the Big Sick. That's for sure. But and I mean, it's always interesting to me. Like, you know, I didn't get to really talk about the festival last year, about how some things worked and some things didn't. Like last year, I was really looking forward to The Lure, and that movie just doesn't work for me on so many different levels. I mean, you can read my review about The Lure and see I was being generous about it. But I mean, ultimately, the film just doesn't work the same way that this doesn't work for me. So again, you know, take it with a grain of salt. And I'll be back for my next movie, which is going to be Gemini. So I will talk to you after I get back from that movie. It is approximately about 11:35, and I'm on the freeway driving home, and I'm going to talk to you about Gemini. But before I do, there's not going to be another movie for this for today. I thought that I was going to be able to make a screening of something, but the Gemini screening and Q&A went on a little bit longer than I had expected. And by the time I had gotten out and two over to the Chinese, the 10:45 showing that I was going to go to, the only showing that was that late, had already started. So I was not able to see what I was going to see, so I just kind of moved beyond it and just decided to go home. But I did get to see Gemini, written and directed by Aaron Katz, starring Lola Kirk and Zoe Kravitz, among others. It's a good, solid thriller. Like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I was not expecting what Gemini is. And I think that there's, like, the thing that I think I loved more than anything about the film was the score, which, as you probably, when you read my review, I'll talk a little bit more about that, but how the score kind of eschews any kind of like the throwback scores that we've been getting. I mean, I don't mind them, but you know, when everybody is doing a Carpenter inspired score for any sort of genre material, it does get really fucking boring. It does get fucking repetitive. I mean, you know, how many times can we ape the John Carpenter style? And Aaron Katz didn't do that. He kind of, like, this film is heavily influenced by, like, the psychosexual thrillers of the 90s, like late night steamy erotic thrillers, things like Curtis Hanson thrillers. I think that's something that Aaron Katz had talked about, like the early 90s thrillers that Curtis Hanson had written and directed. Like, that's what he referenced as things that he was not so much modeling, but kind of inspired by. What I really like about this film and Aaron Katz in general is how he's able to, like, I feel like when somebody is referencing and homaging nowadays, it feels like they're just ripping off. They're not even, like, processing it and pushing it through their own kind of fixture and their own cinematic lens, like the best filmmakers do. That's what Katz does. Like, he takes these references, and he doesn't wholly, like, one-for-one ratio. Like, I felt like a heavy influence on this film was Body Double. It really does feel like Body Double is the De Palma film is this, like, it's a pretty big reference point because of, and you'll see as when the movie's released in 2018 what I'm talking about, but it's a film that doesn't take its references and just shows them to you. It kind of mixes it into a blender and gives you this great little mystery noir, a neo-noir. I know that the people that I that I'd seen it with, and we were talking afterwards, and they felt like the movie fell apart in its third act. I don't see it like that, because I don't think, for myself, what I saw what Aaron Katz was doing was commenting on more on, less on like the conventions of like a sexual thriller, psychosexual thriller, or like those kinds of movies, but he's using the framework for it to discuss something else, which I feel like he's more discussing friendship and codependency within friendships, and how like the personal and business can get very messy. And I think it works. I think that he lands the ending that he wants to land. It's, to me, it's not a question of, oh, well, you know, I wasn't expecting it to go one way or the other. But I can understand how people would be pissed off by this ending. It worked for me. So just be warned. It feels like, Scott Phillips, sometimes special guest had made reference to that too to me, and I just don't feel it. Like, I feel like the ending lands, and it lands in the way that it needs to. Lola Kirk, fuck, she's great. She's super fucking awesome. She was the one thing I liked about Mistress America. I did not like Mistress America whatsoever. But I did really, really like her and the work that she did there. And so this is kind of like making good on the promise of Mistress America, because I definitely like Gemini a lot more than I do Mistress America. But it's more to my sensibilities. And like, what I loved about the whole entire film is the chemistry between Zoe Kravitz and Lola Kirk. But please do not mistake this shit. It's not sexual chemistry. It's just the way that they bounced off one another was not just relaxed, but it had a charm and an electricity to it that, like, it feels like they're friends, and they just had great chemistry together. I would love to see them in more work together. So any kind of filmmakers that are out there that may be possibly listening to the B-Movie Podcast, watch Gemini and check out like Zoe Kravitz and Lola Kirk and how they fucking kill it in the movie. And of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention two guys that actually show up in this film that don't play big roles but have pretty interesting cameos. One is John Cho, who manages to be very not creepy, but very uncomfortable, like making the entire scenes that the entirety of the scenes that he's in very uncomfortable as this detective. It's a very different but very similar performance as what he did this year in Columbus, the great, vastly underseen work by Koganaga, the visual artist. It's brilliant, brilliant film. I definitely recommend watching that. But John Cho, yeah. And somebody who has not been covered on the B-Movie Podcast, but definitely is a guy on the rise that we really like, James Ransone from In the Valley of Violence, shows up here in a little cameo playing this like younger douchey actor douchebag. And he does it so well. I mean, that's just a compliment to his style and prowess as an actor. I'm not saying it because James Ransone is actually a douche. He's not. From by all accounts, I've heard he's a great guy. So, but this one's a keeper. Like, I'm definitely excited. Neon is actually releasing this in 2018. And I hope that you guys all go see it, because it's definitely a lot of fun. And it's a definite great change up of genre and vibe that everybody's been referencing the fucking Carpenter thing, and it's getting a little tired for me. And to see somebody not do that, fuck, it's great. And it would figure that Neon would pick something up like this, because they are always on the forefront of getting up edgy material. I mean, they used to be Draft House Films, now they're Neon. So, yeah, look for this one in probably a couple of months, hopefully. So I am officially finished for the day. I just watched the one and only movie that I'm going to see on Sunday. I've got a ton of reviews to do, and unfortunately, they've decided to fuck with us again and change the schedule again for special screenings. It was just announced that I'm not going to be able to see Molly's Game at this film festival because they changed Molly's Game from a special screening to the closing night film. This is like the third or fourth time that they've changed the closing night film, which has kind of wreaked havoc on people's schedule because I was scheduled to be at the Egyptian the entire night tonight, it being Sunday. And yeah, that just got changed. It got kind of fucked up because they canceled the Molly's Game screening, which I'm really disappointed about, but that's with an asterisk, but it's not going to ruin my day. I've got a ton of reviews to write up from over the weekend that I just have not gotten been able to get to. And plus, I think I'm coming down with a cold, festival flus. Look it up. It's a real fucking thing, guys. But it's to say that I did get to see an amazing 70 millimeter print of Dunkirk, followed by a Q&A by the director himself, Christopher Nolan. And I mean, you guys should know this already. Dunkirk is a theatrical experience that is on par with seeing Lawrence of Arabia in 70 millimeter. It's a theatrical experience. I'm not saying that Dunkirk is on the level of Lawrence of Arabia, but the way that it should be viewed should be on a really big screen and or on IMAX. You know, not LIMAX, but a real IMAX, a real big screen IMAX. You know, that are few and far between, or see it in 70 millimeter. This is my second time seeing it in 70. And I will tell you that I think that this is my preferred format. I think it's because I can, like, I'm not engulfed by the screen like I did when I saw it in IMAX. I think in a lot of ways it was a little bit too much seeing it in that format, but I think 70 is that perfect kind of the perfect balance between like overwhelming and big screen like amazing. But I mean, I still suggest that everybody see it in the biggest IMAX just to see what I'm talking about, how it's an overwhelming like visual and auditory experience. And My opinion hasn't changed about Dunkirk. It's a technical marvel. It's exactly what you would expect from Christopher Nolan. I think that he is the master technical director of our time. In a really weird way, he's a spiritual cousin to Stanley Kubrick. Not in the way that like the way that his films are interpreted, but just in the mastery of like the technical aspects of filmmaking. The film is impeccable. Like it's literally technically perfect. I don't see this, you don't see the seams in the technique at play in this film. And I mean, that's a thing to marvel at. I mean, it truly is. And coupled with another movie that's about, in a very periphery way, Dunkirk, in a very periphery way, Darkest Hour, which I just saw like last week, it kind of made this really interesting, informed double feature about Dunkirk and that moment in history where the British, like, you know, to escape was to survive and was a victory. And it kind of gives you this really interesting scope of that particular time period. But Dunkirk is, like I said, is amazing, and we were treated to a approximately 30 to 35 minute a Q&A with Nolan. And I will say this much: you can actually read my cover. You'll read my coverage on on the site on Film Dispenser. But what I can tell you that I'm not sure if I really got across properly was, just how warm like Christopher Nolan is as a personality, as being interviewed. Like, I think that it's always been, like, I've always felt that he was stiff in interviews, like when I watched the special features, and here he was very relaxed and charming, even making a few jokes, one specifically that I could not stop laughing at because of the fact that he, like, I mean, he made a very relevant joke to you know, 2017 with the killing of a sacred deer. But I'm pretty sure that you can read my coverage about it and look up the Q&A, and you'll probably find it on AFI. I don't know what the plan is for them, if they're planning on releasing this Q&A or not. But it was really nice to not have a fluffy PR conversation gotten out of Christopher Nolan, and it was very technical. They talked about his process of writing, directing, editing, sound mixing. It was all done within a 30-minute time frame, and it kind of gave you a better appreciation. It didn't kind of, it really did give you a better appreciation of the kind, how Christopher Nolan approaches filmmaking in general, and it makes perfect sense when you hear him talk about it, and talk about it in a very engaged setting. Like, he was very engaged with the interviewer and how the questions that were brought up. So it was well worth it. Like I said, it's going to be my last movie of the day. I'll be back on Monday to fight another day. But I mean, with the fact that they canceled Molly's Game, it kind of really defeated me. I'm really tired. Like I said, I got a festival flu heading up. And even though you probably can't tell from my voice, but it's all to say I'm gonna call it a day right here and just try to get some rest and some writing in to finish up some of these reviews that I got stockpiling. So we are talking about Fits and Starts. Written and directed by Laura Taroso. It's her debut feature, and starring Wyatt Cenac and Greta Lee. Now, this movie is kind of like the movie that I think that Mr. Roosevelt wants to be, but couldn't, but it just isn't. And don't be offended. I really disliked it, but I'm not trying to beat up Mr. Roosevelt. It was such I just had such a rejection of that movie, and come to find that Fits and Starts is kind of exactly, I think, the movie that Mr. Roosevelt was trying to be, in a different way, but kind of saying things about artists and being, you know, early in your career as an artist, but not only that, but you know what those kinds of relationships that you have when you're an artist. And I feel like Fits and Starts does it so much better. And a lot of the success of Fits and Starts has to do with Greta Lee and Wyatt Cenac as the couple, David and Jennifer. They're writers. Both are novelists, and Jennifer's books, she has like 3 books in print, are like bestsellers, and she's becoming quite the name, whereas David has floundered has floundered in the collegiate / writer's world, writer's workshop world, just never being able to sell his debut feature. And there's tension in the relationship, and what it charts is that tension along with that culminates in this one night where they go to this writer's salon that I won't ruin what happens in the meat of the film, but needless to say, it's a really refreshing look at two people who truly care for one another and love each other and are attracted to one another, but they're going through what you would consider a rough patch. And it's how these two manage to find each other again. I know it sounds hokey, but it's not. It's a very positive movie. This is not your typical, like, what I found refreshing about it was, is that it stars all the regulars of an indie comedy of a certain type. You'll know who I'm talking about. I'll let you look at the cast list. And most of those fucking films end with people cheating, or the main thrust of those movies / TV shows are people fucking around, while they're in relationships, basically cheating. And I just tell you guys, like, I have a fucking low tolerance for it, just because we see that all the time. That's just kind of manufactured drama. Give me something truthful. And I think that Fits and Starts does that. It gives you something truthful without having your two characters cheat on one another. Like that's the last thing that's on these characters' minds. And I think that a lot of people are going to find this one and really, really dig it. They're like, it's going to be one of those films that's going to raise in esteem as the months and the years go by, and it gets, you know, it starts getting seen by a bunch of people, because it has a very commercial framework. Like, Tessaru, she understands how comedy, like how a comedy film is structured. I mean, you replace these two leads and you pop in some, like, you know, you pop in some popular, A-list actor and actress, comedic actress, and you probably will have a pretty sizable hit. I mean, that's how well constructed this film is. So don't think of this movie as a meandering, plotless, aimless kind of, like, treatise on youth, a la another film that I saw at AFI. It's not that. It's actually quite the surprise, and I hope that people do find this one. So, I'm in my car again, taking a break, and I've just seen Pendular, which is a Brazilian film by a reasonably new director. And it kind of bowled me over. I was not expecting it. I was not expecting the film that it was. Julia Amorat is the director. She's the writer-director. And she's directed, she's definitely directed other things. This is actually the first film that I've seen from her. This is her fourth film, actually. And, actually, it's her third film, but this is actually based off of her short film that she made, a few years back. And, I will give you the premise. The premise is that a dancer and a sculptor in Brazil, specifically in Rio, have rented an industrial space, and they divide the space for each other, and what they're going to do is work separately but together on their respective projects. The dancer, of course, is working on a new show, and the sculptor is working on his newest installation. And what precedes this particular setup is a dissection of relationships, art, the meaning of art, why we actually do art, how it commingles in our relationships, the healthy and the unhealthy of our in our relationships, and lots of sex. I have to be very upfront about this. This film is very mature, and it has a very European sensibility when it comes to the relationship that it's being, that it's portraying. By European, I mean that there's frank and explicit, like, sex scenes in this film, but they absolutely have everything to do with the film. They're not salacious. They're not meant to be anything but to inform where these characters are in their relationship. There's a lot going on in this film. There's so much visual storytelling and use of music and editing and just so much embedded in the film and the way that it's told that I'm still a little shaken by the film, even like, you know, it's been about 20 or 30 minutes since I've seen it, and it's still kind of rocking in my head and trying to dissect everything that I'd seen. This is a film that I am going to return to. I'm definitely going to return to this because it is such a sledgehammer of a film. Like, it, like if you are in a certain mood and you are a certain kind of a film goer, this film will bowl you over. What I love about the film is how it takes a very unpretentious look at dance and at sculpting. I mean, it's very pragmatic in the way that it portrays these particular artists. And the beautiful thing that Marat is able to do is she's able to give our main character, because the film is told, even though it is a dual story, I feel like the balance is a little bit shifted towards Alice, the dancer. But there's a whole purpose for that. In talking about that, it would ruin part of the film, or it would ruin the film. But I will say this much, is that if you are one that thinks that interpretive dance or dance is something that is that you'll never understand, I think that this film is a perfect distillation of the emotion of interpretive / expressive dance, or modern dance as it's known. And the beautiful thing is that it never tells you this. It just shows you, and through character and through this beautiful editing that to me kind of recalls the way that Nick Rogue edits. Like, and not in that elliptical editing sort of way where he shifts through time. That's one thing, but I think that what people don't really talk about with Nick Rogue, that I think that Marat actually has down, is the ability to like not just use editing as a time shift, but an emotional shift, like either it being a weaponized use of editing or the lack thereof. The film culminates in this like just amazing moment where Alice's character dances, and she dances to a very specific song. And like I said, it's a very unique experience. So if you're of a certain type of person, I think that it's going to bowl you over like the way that it did for me. It's as strong of a film that I've seen this year, that's just the right side of esoteric. But with, like I said, without the pretension of like what the concept is. Like, I know that you're thinking about this right now and going, it's about a dancer and a sculptor with a lot of sex. It sounds very fucking pretentious to me. It's not. It's not. Not in any way, shape, or form. I really hope they've not given us really very much to go on within the way of press materials. So I don't know what the distribution is on this film. I hope and pray to God that this does have some distribution. I really hope that, because of the fact that it wowed critics at Berlin, and AFI had heard that, and I guess from what I understood, acquired it for the festival because of the fact that it wowed critics at Berlin, and I can see why. I hope that this is Brazil's like nomination for best foreign language film, because if it is, it probably will get nominated, and that means that people will be able to see this at a certain point. But I think that this film is just it's one of those films that you have to see for yourself to see if to truly kind of process whether or not it's it's going to be something that it's, this one's a love it or hate it. There's no middle ground for this one. And I definitely fall strongly on the love side. This one's going to be really quick. I just finished up Jim and Andy, it's not Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond. It's Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond, with a special contractually obligated appearance by Tony Clifton. That's the name of the fucking movie. But I'm just going to call it Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond, which is a documentary that's actually going to be available on Netflix as of, I think, November 17th. And I'm suggesting to everybody that I know to watch this, especially film geeks, because this film is a slice of mania. It's really fucking insane, but kind of brilliant, as it kind of dissects what people have heard about people going quote unquote method, and like seeing a ground level view of it. Basically, what ends up happening is that Jim Carrey is, of course, announced as the lead in Man on the Moon, which is the Andy Kaufman biopic. Now, a little bit of back history, what they don't tell you in this film is that initially Edward Norton was cast in this film and then dropped out for various reasons. I cannot remember why, but it was lucky for us that Jim Carrey had gotten the role, because he was kind of perfect for this role. But what you end up finding out through this documentary is it's kind of framed that this whole thing of going true method really broke Jim Carrey. But what it does is they filmed, like, they were given access, the filmmakers that made this film were given access to hundreds of hours of behind the scenes footage of Jim Carrey doing his method process, which was being in character as Andy the entire filming of Man on the Moon. And if you've ever want to see something like this, like, you know, you've heard about Daniel Day-Lewis doing this, you've heard about other actors going quote-unquote method, I strongly suggest seeing it, because the way that it affects the crew, the way, I mean, Milos Forman, you like, just watch it for, like, the put-upon, like, Milos Forman looks like a dude who went, I'm done. I mean, literally at the end of this movie, you could almost feel him just like putting his hands up in the air and says, I'm fucking done. I'm going to go back to Czechoslovakia and just, I'm going to go back to the Czech Republic and just not make films anymore, because of how much shit he went through. But it's not to say that this is like a criticism of Jim Carrey. It's just, this is what happens when somebody goes full method. And it's sort of a brilliant dissection of that, and just jaw-dropping at what footage you can see. You can only imagine that there's even crazier footage out there of this particular of these particular, I would hate to use the word antics, but it's kind of seems like it in a certain way, because it's very much so like what Andy Kaufman was all about, the whole blurring the lines of reality and fantasy. I definitely strongly suggest you see it. If you've not seen Man on the Moon, you don't need to have seen it, but I think that seeing it after you watch this will kind of give you a better appreciation for the movie itself. So yeah, go ahead and check it out. It'll be on Netflix on November 17th. I'm taking a little break because I just saw Madame Hyde, the new Isabelle Huppert movie. This one is a peculiar one. It's not that to say that it's bad. I don't think that it's a bad movie. I actually really enjoyed it. It's a play on the, of course, because it's called Mrs. Hyde in English, it's a play on Robert Louis Stevenson's film, as you can tell, I'm a little punch drunk right now, the novel by Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, except for it's transposed to modern day Paris at a technical school, which you need to know a little bit about French culture to get into this one. Not a lot. It's just like, you know, when you watch it, just be prepared that the school that she teaches for is kind of, I hate to use the word like inner city, but it's the equivalent of an inner city with a like kind of a program that aims towards more towards mechanical things like mechanics and engineering. It's all played very subtly, but you can tell that this is kind of a critique of the of this particular kind of brand of schooling. I think that the movie is, it's just this like really interesting, brilliant dissection in a very subtle and obscure way of not just superhero films, which I know sounds weird, but when you watch it, you'll understand, but also of like France's culture of like sweeping children under the rug, but also, you know, not being really, not saying that everybody's an innocent. Like, this film is very, there's a lot to unpack on this film, especially if you're not familiar with French culture, which I'm only slightly, have an understanding of the culture just from the things that I've read and movies that I've seen, so take that as you will, but as it stands, it's got this really great Isabelle Huppert performance, but I don't think that I've ever seen a film starring Isabelle Huppert that her performance was lacking. The film may have not been up to snuff, but the performance is never lacking, but this film is definitely in tune with exactly what she's doing, and it's kind of like a quiet, brilliant little film that I hope that more people, like a lot of people, will see, or eventually will see. I just want everybody to see anything that Isabelle Huppert does. Stay tuned in 2018 because we may be doing a full-on series of Isabelle Huppert's films. That's not just a hint. That's, a straight-up, like, you know, announcement. Yes, we are going to have a long-term series about Isabelle Huppert. But when, and the movies that are going to be embedded into it, that's completely up in the air. So, but I can definitely tell you that. And this movie kind of, like, finalized it for me that I definitely need to, you know, she's a powerhouse. She's one of my favorite actors. Not anything like gender bias or anything. She's just one of my favorite actors, period. The way that Spencer Howard, the progenitor of Film Dispenser, are the grand poobah, if you will, how he feels about Juliette Binoche is the way that I feel about Isabelle Huppert, which is to say that she's an amazing woman, a powerhouse actress, actor that rivals. I will go to bat for her over Daniel Day-Lewis and any other actor out there any day of the week, just because she literally has hundreds and hundreds of films that you can watch and just take a master course in acting. And I mean, you know, Madame Hyde, all the same. And plus, anybody who can introduce you to Michael Haneke and make you like sit down and actually watch a Michael Haneke film, which is both a knock and a praise for Haneke, because I have a very complex relationship with this dude and him as a filmmaker. You cannot deny that. So it's in theaters, right? It will be in theaters in 2018, from what I understand, and you definitely should check it out. Some movies surprise you because of they exceed your expectations. Some actually surprise you because you had really low expectations and they far surpass them. And then there are those other ones where you're not expecting, you don't know what to expect, and all the same, you kind of have an idea, but then you're completely blown away by just how well made, executed, directed, written, acted, the whole package is there. And that's like the sum of Lefty Brown, the Ballad of Lefty Brown, written and directed by Jared Moshe, in his debut feature length film, starring Bill Pullman in a career best performance, Peter Fonda, Tommy Flanagan, and Jim Caviezel, and Kathy Baker, not Kathy Bates, but Kathy Baker. I know that many people will go, oh, Kathy Baker's in it, or Kathy Bates? No, Kathy Baker. Picket Fences is Kathy Baker. And it's this Western that bucks every convention, but by doing so is allowed to be a very classic Western. It just hit me in all the right places. Shot on 35mm, and just taking the conventions that you know and twisting them in just such the right way, and not done, like, you could tell when you watch this film, if you're a Western fan, after it's finished, you'll know that Jared Moshe has an unabiding love for Westerns. Like, he does not... He's not playing with Westerns so that he could make something a little bit more modern. No, this is like you could literally see, like, if there was meta within Golden Age Hollywood, that this is at a certain point something that Howard Hawks or John Ford would do. And basically, I'll give you the premise. The premise is basically, imagine John Wayne and Walter Brennan were in a movie, late era, and within the first 5 minutes, John Wayne is shot and killed brutally, leaving Walter Brennan to have to exact his revenge on the people that murdered this lawman. And that is the Ballad of Lefty Brown. I mean, they went as far as to cast Peter Fonda as like the John Wayne role, and of course Bill Pullman plays the Walter Brennan role. And what transpires after that first 10 minutes is one of the surprising delights of the festival. I really wanted to see it. I wanted to see it on the big screen, and I was bowled over by how great this film is. This is going to be one that I'm going to buy on Blu-ray, and it's going to be like in heavy rotation. Just like in a very different way, Bone Tomahawk is in heavy rotation. While I'm writing or doing things around the house, it's that kind of movie that just plays even better and better once you've seen it a few times. So with that, guys, please, when it's already out on DirecTV On Demand with this deal with A24, and I know that A24 is releasing it on, I think, VOD and some more theaters in December, I'm going to suggest that you wait till December and watch it in a theater. Try to find it, because, holy God, the 35mm photography is just gorgeous. And it's such a rare thing to see a Western on a big screen nowadays. And, I mean, I saw it at the Hollywood Egyptian, and that is probably the best place that you could see this film. I was about four rows away from the front, and just the experience of it all was just a delight. So yeah, Lefty Brown, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, out now on DirecTV On Demand, and I think coming December 12th, December 15th, I think, on VOD and in theaters by A24. Please support this one. This one's special, and you Western fans are definitely going to love this one. Just got out of I, Tonya, the film directed by Craig Gillespie, starring the very, very, very talented and amazing Margaret Robbie and Allison Janney, Sebastian Stan. This one's a fucking contender. This is just... This is a ballsy, ballsy film. It's not, I think, what you exactly expect it to be, because this is a movie that dares you to empathize with one of the most hated women in all of sportsdom, and probably in America, Tonya Harding. And the way that it gets you to empathize with her by telling her whole story and never, ever, ever portraying it as some sort of some sort of joke, even though the trailers would make you indicate that it's some sort of, you know, stupid people doing stupid things, kind of true crime thriller, which it is in a way, but it's done not in the way that most people do it. I mean, the most apt description I could give you guys is that I know that a lot of people have been saying it's the Martin Scorsese or it's the Goodfellas of figure skating movies, and yeah, whatever, fucking guys, whatever you want to say to sell fucking your, you know, get hits on your fucking, your page, it's great. No, this feels like a Coen Brothers film. This feels like a spiritual cousin to Fargo, because the way that they write the figures in this film, the way that they're able to truly, like, the way that it's able to truly kind of get how dim bulbs work and be able to give you that point of view. Wow, it is extremely well made in that regard. And like I said, it's an empathy machine. It's made to not, now, like, I mean, you know, like, again, let me be clear. I'm not saying that it makes Tonya Harding sympathetic. It makes you empathetic towards her. It gives you a better understanding of her. And that all rests on Margaret Robbie's shoulders. I mean, this is a fucking powerhouse performance. I run the B-Movie podcast, so you guys know I'm not really, like, you know, into the Oscar race, even though it interests me from a distance. But I would be very surprised if Margaret Robbie does not walk away with a nomination, and she will be pushing hard in trying to get that golden statue of hers, the best actress. I mean, she works so hard, so much so that it allows people like Allison Janney and Sebastian Stan to look just great and shine and give them the those moments where they're allowed to be the kooky characters within the film, and they're allowed to have those moments. And you know, Robbie has those, but this movie is so much about her having to do the heavy lifting, but making it just look just easy and just like, it's an amazing performance that you literally have to see. Like, if there's one thing that, if there's like one summer, like wintertime award season movie that I would suggest that B movie fans see, it's this one. Like, because it so defies expectations and gives you something that it just knocks you on your ass, and it continues to knock you on your ass. Yeah, see this one when it comes out. It should be out around December 8th in limited release, and then going wider and wider from Neon releasing. This one's a winner, guys. It's going to be a. I hope it's going to get people a lot of attention, or it gets a lot of attention, because it's definitely worth it.
Welcome back. So, as you noticed, the movie that I'm specifically talking about that wasn't in the film, in the actual list of entries, was Bodied. It wasn't because I couldn't formulate thoughts. It's just, when I saw it, I was bowled over by just how good this film is. I know that a lot of film critics have been raving and ranting about this film since it was dropped on at Toronto Film Festival, The Midnight Madness. But this film is legit. This, like, of all the films I saw at 2017 AFI Film Fest, this is the one that I feel like deserves the most attention. I mean, it's basically the tied for my favorite film of the fest between that and The Shape of Water, but they're two completely different films. And Bodied is more, everybody's going to love Shape of Water. We just know it. It's Guillermo. You know, it's him at his best, but in a new kind of phase in his career. This is Joseph Kahn. Like, Bodied is Joseph Kahn just smacking motherfuckers in the face, and then smacking them, but then also punching them in the face, and in the best way possible. I mean, this isn't a gut punch. This is like a fucking punch to the fucking face. This is like, you know, beating down motherfuckers in the best way possible. I don't want to ruin it because it deserves to be seen. And from what I understand, Joseph Kahn has distribution for it now, or he's in negotiations to have distribution for it in 2018, which I'm thankful for, which means that because he's said in interviews that this film, he refuses to give it up to distribution because he wants it uncut. He doesn't want to cut any of the language, any of the thematics that are in this film. And I applaud him. This is like the best cutting, critical kind of filmmaking that you could possibly have. But it's done in this really commercial package that I think that a lot of people are not going to, it's going to go way past them. I mean, this is, for any of the people that doubted Joseph Kahn's skill as a filmmaker, this is the thesis statement for him. This is his like beginning of his journey as a specific filmmaker. I mean, we've already covered Torque on the B Movie Podcast. We fucking love Joseph Kahn. His Detention, I'm trying to figure out a way to actually put Detention on the podcast, but now because of the fact that I know that that Bodied is getting distribution, I'm totally holding off until it gets a release, and then we'll do Detention at the same time. I'm just also trying to figure out what fucking movie to put it with, because it is an unclassifiable movie, but a brilliant dissertation on high school movies, the ADD generation, the social media age, slasher films. It fucking does everything. It eviscerates and blows up everything and manages to compact itself into something new. Very much so like what Body does. I'm really, really, really psyched for you guys to see this. You have no idea how happy I am that he got distribution for the film. You can read my review on the website on filmdispenser.com. I would totally tell you to read that review to see my thoughts. And now just a little bit of like kind of like wrapping up summary of the AFI 2017 Film Fest. I would say my favorite movie of this film festival has to be Bodied. When you see it, you'll completely understand why this is one of my favorite films of the festival. The best film is Del Toro's The Shape of Water. It feels like, in a lot of ways, it feels similar to the change that you saw in Wes Anderson in The Grand Budapest Hotel, and how that kind of demarked a new phase for Wes Anderson, or even Moonrise Kingdom. It feels like in that kind of way, where an artist who has a very specific vision has changed and turned the page into a new phase in his career, which I'm really excited for. I can understand why he wants to take off a year. I can only imagine the making of this film was difficult, to say the least. It is an impressive, impressive, beautiful film, and one of my favorite romances probably in the last 10 or 15 years. I have to see it more. I've only seen it the one time. I've only had my thoughts and allowed me to kind of percolate on it, but it definitely has one of my favorite moments in all of cinema in 2017, and probably in the last 5 years. It just, like, it's a black and white moment, shot in black and white, that just, it breaks my heart because it is so beautiful, and it gets to the soul of Guillermo del Toro as a filmmaker. You'll know it when you see it. Best performance of the fest has to go to Margot Robbie in I, Tonya. I mentioned it in the diaries. This woman is, she's a titan. With this performance, this is next level. This takes her to the next level as an actor. This is the thing that where I think a lot of people, like whoever her critics are going to shut the fuck up real quick with this one. any movie that she goes toe-to-toe, anybody goes toe-to-toe with a completely unhinged Allison Janney, and at the end of the film, you still remember the star in Margot Robbie, and you still remember her performance over a very showy, very awesome performance by Allison Janney, you know that you have something special. A runner-up would probably be a tie between Sally Hawkins in Shape of Water and Bill Pullman, who does a career best performance as Lefty Brown in The Ballad of Lefty Brown. So it was a great year for AFI Film Fest. They had a lot of great films. There were the management of it really stressed me out. I'll be honest, it really, really stressed me out the way that they kept on shifting things. I mean, I know that upon reflection, I know that they had a lot of shit go down. I mean, especially because All the Money in the World was supposed to premiere. But then, of course, you know, Ridley Scott went baller on everybody, pulled the movie from the film fest and decided to replace Kevin Spacey with Christopher Plummer. I mean, that is a fucking great punk rock move for the man. And I applaud that. But AFI, I think, could have handled it a little bit better by committing to, you know, competing to a closing night film, and committing to it, which caused a lot of issues, in flexing and shifting. But it's all to say, at the end of the day, it was a stronger fest than even last year, and I really loved last year. I didn't get to as many foreign films as I would have liked to have, but the things that I did see were super strong. I wish I had gotten to see the Haneke film, Happy End, and then I also wish that I could have saw Let the Corpses Tan, which were two films that I really, really am upset that I missed, but I know that they're coming out fairly soon, so I'll be able to get to see them. Especially Happy End, because, you know, Haneke and Isabelle Huppert together is some baller shit. I would not miss that joint. And I won't. As soon as it's released theatrically, I'm going to go see that shit. So next week, I hope that you enjoyed this, but next week we are starting we're starting a series in honor of Star Wars The Last Jedi coming out. We're actually going to be doing a sci-fi themed month that we're calling Star Wars-ish. And what we're going to be doing is looking at various titles that were made during that time frame in the 80s where, you know, you could sell something on it being Star Wars. So we're going to look at a lot of different films, a lot of great films, some forgotten films, and a few surprises. So look out for Star Wars-ish, and then it's coupling films that are preceding it with some special episodes, maybe possibly some special guests. You'll just have to see, but I had so much fun with the Star Trek podcast last year, the Star Trek series, Boldly 50, that I felt that it was only fitting that we do more sci-fi and get some shit in there and get some fun stuff. Beginning the first full week of December, you're gonna get your B movie Star Wars style double feature podcast. So look out for that shit. And you can always read my work and the work of my colleagues on filmdispenser.com. I'm gonna pimp the Film Dispenser Prime podcast. Scott Phillips, and of course the progenitor of Film Dispenser, the editor in chief, Spencer Howard. That's the podcast that they host that gives you all of your pop culture needs beyond just film. They look at TV. I think they've even talked about a couple of books and some different apps. Go ahead and get up on that because they're doing some really great shit. You know, I may not be all on board with the Riverdales. Scotty, I'm sorry, but, you know, come on now, dude. I've tried to watch it. I tried to get into it. I just can't. I don't see what you guys are seeing. All I see is a blatant ripoff of Twin Peaks. But then again, we don't talk about TV here. You guys know that. But it's all to say, check out Film Dispenser Prime. I love the podcast. I'm listening to it all the time. And it's not just because these gents are my, like, you know, are my crew. Like, you know, we all write, we're ride or dies. It's not like that. It's because it's a strong, strong podcast. I mean, without them, I would not have one of my favorite, like, you know, I would not have seen one of my favorite films of the year, which is Columbus, which I've not talked about on this podcast, but it is one of a favorite of mine. And it was based off of the recommendation of Scott Phillips and Spencer Howard, as they actually did an episode on Columbus, which I strongly suggest you actually go and listen to that. But it's all to say, it's really good stuff, and I really hope that you guys listen to that. And you can also listen to, if you're excited about my Star Wars stuff that I'm going to be doing, you can listen to the Utini Cast, which is also on the Film Dispenser podcast network and the website, where me and Spencer actually talk about all things Star Wars related. So with that, guys, you can reach out to Twitter and Instagram, BMoviePod, the letter B, the word movie, the word pod, all together, no lines, no dashes, no bullshit. And thank you for listening, and we'll talk soon.